This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Micah Pollack is a professor of economics at Indiana University Northwest with a campus in Gary, and he's taken to Twitter in many months, it seems, for at least certainly since the start of the pandemic, to look into some of the data that has come out in turn dealing with the coronavirus pandemic that we are facing these days. And he is with us to talk about some of the newest information and maybe some other thoughts, too, about what we've all been experiencing lately from the CDC about the vaccinations, as well as, I guess, the guidance that's come out recently about mask wearing. And first off, Micah, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
Well, if you will, start out first. Give us some of the latest data that you have come up with that you put out there on your Twitter feed that give us some guidance or some ideas, at least, on how the effectiveness of vaccines have been doing.
Yeah, so I've been really enjoying switching from tracking cases and infections and hospitalizations to looking more at vaccination rates. It's a much more uplifting and positive thing to look at, and we've been doing quite well. We recently went through, I guess you would call it the third wave or the fourth wave in cases here in Indiana, and Northwest Indiana in particular, and it was very mild. It started in the middle of March. We kind of peaked in early April, and cases are back declining again, positivity rates dropping, and a big reason for that is that we've been doing really well in vaccinations. And so the people that traditionally would have gotten sick, the older groups, the higher risk groups, they're more or less vaccinated now, and so there really wasn't anywhere for the virus to go, and we had a very mild wave here.
I know that the latest information that comes out from the Indiana Department of Health and the color-coded maps, which is what I think most people will get a chance to take a look at and try and figure out how they're doing in the state, or at least in particular counties, show that we have some counties that things have gotten better and some counties that things suddenly turn worse. But that's just a very, very quick and very short snapshot, is it not, of what the real situation's like?
Yeah, and they also tend to lag a little bit because they're only updated once a week based on, you know, data from a few days earlier than that. So when you're looking at that snapshot, you could be looking at data from over a week ago, and it's really in the last 1.5 weeks or so that things have really started to improve. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see those color charts improving across the state in the next, you know, week or so here.
In what information you've gathered, as well as what you take a look at from the state and on the national level, do you think that we're in this situation now, that the CDC guidance that just came out here about mask wearing and how to protect yourself from the virus have changed a little bit, but it's certainly looking more positive, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we're well on the path to returning to normal or very close to normal over this summer, which I'm really excited about. I mean, there's still some uncertainty out there with variants and, you know, with the global spread happening the way it is, there's always a chance that something more severe could arise. But I think that, you know, barring anything like that, we're in a good place and we're on track to have something very close to a normal summer.
I know that you've joined with other of your professors at Indiana University, and I'm sure other campuses, as need be, to take a look at the data that has come out and put together what turned out to be a very interesting paper that just recently got out about infectious diseases and in particular about COVID-19. You took a look in specifics about Indiana. Will you tell us first the objective that you all had put together in getting the data together as well as doing the study itself?
Sure. So back in the summer of 2020, as schools were thinking about reopening and how they would do the reopening, we kind of saw an opportunity to look at how different districts reopening in different ways affected the spread of the coronavirus in those communities. So if you have a community that, you know, does primarily e-learning, do you see a reduction in cases there? And if you have a school district that goes primarily in person, do you see a large spike in cases there? And so we were able to collect data from all the school districts in Indiana on how they were planning on reopening, and then combine that with the case data from the State Department of Health and look at over the fall how different reopening plans affected the spread of the virus in those communities.
When you obviously had enough information together to start out the work on this, what did you and your colleagues that were working on the study put together? What information did you gather together? What types of information, I should say, that you gathered together to be able to come up with enough data to be able to show how the spread of the COVID-19 has been around not only communities and counties, but also the schools as well?
Yeah, so we actually individually contacted every school district in the state of Indiana and got data from them on when their school district was going to reopen and what their plans were and how many students they would have in person versus doing e-learning. And going into this, I think I expected that we would probably see a pretty significant effect, right? If you have a lot of students sitting in a classroom in a school every day, even with precautions, that has to lead to more spread, I thought, than, you know, when everybody's at home doing their learning remote, where, you know, spread obviously can't happen. And so going into this, I really expected that, you know, more in-person school districts would have substantially more spread in the communities. And we see a significant effect, but it's relatively small. It turned out to be relatively minor, which was, I think, surprising for me.
Now, I know the conclusion of the paper says that, I guess, there are concerns, I guess, about the spread, of course, of the virus, but it's not as much as what maybe at the start of the school, for both, I guess all school systems for that matter, and then Indiana this year, have really turned out to be. What did you discover along the way that got you to the conclusions?
Well, there was a lot of controversy going in because there wasn't much data and analysis and research on this topic, and so people kind of, you know, took their own personal views and assumed that that was going to be what happens. And so, you know, a lot of people thought schools are going to be super spreader events, and others thought, no, there's not going to be that much spread and we need in-person instruction. And so our goal with this was really to try to quantify how much being in person actually affects the spread of COVID-19 in the community to help school districts and parents and teachers better understand the risks they were being exposed to. So we could tell them something like, well, if you have, you know, 10% more students in your classroom, is that going to lead to, how many new cases is that going to lead to in your community? Is it going to be a lot? Is it going to be small? And the goal is to try to put numbers on this so that you can have a discussion about, you know, the relative costs and benefits of being in person versus e-learning, rather than just kind of everyone taking a stance that's not supported by it necessarily by any research and fighting about it.
Now, of course, you being an economist are looking at the cost of all of this, not only of trying to deal with the virus, but also trying to get schools reopened in many, many cases. Did you find that there was enough information that you all got together, and certainly you did from your part of the study, to show whether it would be a good idea for school districts to go ahead and reopen? Or did you feel, well, we have to have more information, we have to know more about what types of schools should reopen maybe, rather than all the schools in a school district?
We were very careful with this, not to be prescriptive and say schools should be in person or shouldn't. Our goal was to say, okay, here are the results. Here is the effect of being in person more. And it's ultimately a decision that depends on what the parents feel is safe, what the school district feels is safe, whether they decide it's worth being in person or not.
Now, are you going to be able to take the information from this study as well as the conclusion back to the school districts, if they haven't done so already, to say this is what you can do if you want to look at the data in more detail? That's fine. You can kind of extrapolate it across to all of your particular students and teachers and administrators in a district and just make the decision that way.
Yeah, I think we've had a lot of interest from school districts and teachers in this study. I think, you know, optimistically, in some sense, it'll be moot, though, because hopefully in the fall, we won't have a lot of spread. We'll have most of the population vaccinated, even some of the kids. And so I'm really hopeful that while the study was really interesting and fascinating to work on, that in the end, maybe it won't even be needed because things will hopefully be back to normal in the fall.
Is that hope that the CDC guidelines that came out recently are going to be enough to certainly make enough people happy enough to know that they can in certain cases they can remove the masks, they can continue cleaning as they should to make things sanitary as they can for everybody, but not have to go overboard?
Yeah, hopefully, and it's going to be a gradual process, just, you know, physically reopening, but also mentally preparing for this. And I think that we're only starting to see the overwhelming evidence of the effectiveness of the vaccine. So this most recent spike that we saw in Indiana and Northwest Indiana, if you break it down by age group, it was almost entirely flat for everyone over the age of 60. There was no rise in cases whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And the entire spike was driven by those under the age of 60, primarily because those over the age of 60 were already 50% or above vaccinated. And so when you see kind of that stark contrast of, you know, once you get that population group to 50 or 60% vaccinated, cases just are not there anymore. You know, as we roll out the vaccine and we get more people vaccinated, I think over the summer we'll be all become more comfortable seeing case numbers drop and never come back up again, hopefully, because of the vaccine.
Now, I guess you all at the time, of course, didn't have all the information necessary to know about what kind of impact that the variants might have on Indiana schools. Do you think that's something that's going to be the next question that'll have to be answered?
Yeah, so that's one of our limitations is we did this during the fall before there were really widespread variants. And of course, recently with the UK variant, the B117 variant in Michigan in particular has been very severe and led to a lot of hospitalizations and increases in cases. But in Indiana, we are close to Michigan, actually, in terms of the number of B117 cases. So right now we're looking at about 70 to 80% of all cases in Indiana are probably the UK variant. And, you know, that hasn't really affected us the same way it has in Michigan. You know, we saw a small rise, we saw a small spike, but, you know, the vaccine is effective against all the variants so far. And, you know, there's no reason to think that, you know, it won't be unless something dramatic happens. And so I think we're probably in a good shape. I don't think it'll fundamentally change the nature of our results, you know, if you include the B117 variant.
Well, Micah, thank you for spending time with us to talk about this.
Great. Thank you so much, Chris.
A silent movie actress who was born in Michigan City and later became famous as an auto racing driver is the subject of an exhibit that is coming to the LaPorte County Historical Museum, along with a documentary film about her. Kayla Vasilko is a senior in the Honors College at Purdue University Northwest, and we spoke with her earlier about the projects. What interested you the most about deciding to do a project and basically working with the LaPorte County Historical Society on an exhibit for silent movie actress Anita King? Was it strictly because that she's from Michigan City, or was there something else that interested you the most?
I'm an English major. I'm a senior at Purdue University Northwest, so writing has always been something that I have loved. Every year I put on an annual PNW walk called the Star Walk, which is an event to honor lost heroes, lost loved ones in our lives. And about 2 years ago, an English professor by the name of Dr. Jerry Holt came to give a speech at this event. Now, the story that he started to tell was about local silent movie actress Anita King. And when he shared a little bit about her story, I was completely taken aback and in awe. For one, myself and all of the other attendees had no idea that she even had existed, let alone that she was from Michigan City, so close to us. And so when he started to talk about some of the incredible things that she did as a woman, being the first woman to drive cross-country alone without a man, to do all of her own stunts, to be such the fierce activist that she was, I was completely taken. And then he shared that, you know, not really much has been written about her story. Somebody needed to tell her story. And so right away, I wanted to highlight that. The combination of those things that really drew me to that story.
Tell us a little bit about Anita King. I got, well, that her real name was Anna Kepler. I think people in Northwest Indiana may, if they remember her or know about her, they may know her better by that name than the movie name. How did she start out in life, and what prompted her to get involved in movies?
Anita King was one of nine children. Her family had a farm in Michigan City. They dealt with a lot of poverty at that time. She did lose both of her parents. And so to support her siblings and keep the family together, she and her siblings worked as maids in some of the local mansions in Michigan City. And in addition to that, Anita had always wanted to do more with her life, and she took up some stage acting in Chicago. And it was there that she became acquainted with actress Lillian Russell, who saw a lot in Anna back then, and she encouraged her to take her dreams further and pursue a career in Hollywood. It was at that time that she and Anita came up with the stage name Anita King. Mm-hmm. And Anita was able to put everything she had together to get out west, out to Hollywood. Once she got there, she did some modeling in commercials for the auto industry. And it was through these connections that she picked up racing. She had always been a very big enthusiast of car racing, and so she was able to get into this at that time. It was after she had a minor accident in the racing industry that she kind of switched back to acting and got involved with Jesse Lasky of Paramount Pictures and started acting in the silent film.
Will you tell us a little bit about what she was doing when she had gone out to California? She was acting, as you mentioned, and mm-hmm. she also got involved at that time, too, because she liked racing and driving in particular. She mm-hmm. actually picked up the distinction of being the first woman to drive alone across the continental United States from New York to California. Will you tell us a bit more what you learned about her in that respect?
Yeah, so that was really when her career started to pick up. She was doing more and more silent films. But at that time, the Lincoln Highway was about finished. And on set, she heard Mr. Lasky and Mr. DeMille say that it would be many, many years before a woman could complete that drive alone. And when she heard that, Anita had always been a very strong personality, very strong woman. She wanted to prove them wrong. So she approached them and told them that she could, in fact, make that drive completely alone herself. And the company was very excited. They saw this as a great opportunity to shed light on one of their actresses. They partnered with the Kissel Car Company. And Anita was promised a Kissel Car and her very own starring role in a silent movie called The Race, should she be able to accomplish this.
When you've learned more about her racing career, aside from what she had done in the movies at the time, was that kind of the incentive they gave you to go ahead and follow not only her further, but take the project even further and want to create something that folks back here in Northwest Indiana and LaPorte County in particular can actually get to see?
The more that I read about her, specifically about her taking those risks, in the racing industry, taking that risk as a woman driving across country alone at a time that many women were not even allowed to hold their own passports separate from their husbands, I just kept seeing this trend of determination, and I found that so, so inspiring as a young woman myself. And I was able, through research, to connect with her great niece, Lucianne Boardman, and through her, heard even more fantastic stories. Like I said, Anita was dealing with a lot of poverty at the early starts of her career, and she, like so many other starlets of that time, put every penny that they had saved up into getting out to Hollywood. But what happened at that time, that meant that they were left with nothing else. They were basically stuck there. And unfortunately, that left a lot of women, including Anita, kind of as prey of some of the different negative things that were going on from male directors and male actors in Hollywood, since they were stuck there with no resources to go home or support themselves. And so one of the fantastic things that Anita did was when she became successful, she opened a safe house for young women who were trying to pursue their dreams in Hollywood so that they would always have a place to go and stay and save the money to either go home if that's what they wanted or build themselves up there. So it was all of these details, the more that I learned about her, that just further cemented in my mind that her story needed to be shared with the community because it could inspire so many people like it had inspired me.
Now, Kayla, you've gone from the research you've gone through here in the last couple of years, I understand, now to the point where actually there's going to be a creative nonfiction film and documentary coming out that can be seen eventually at the LaPorte County Historical Society Museum. Will you tell us a little bit about the film itself, when it's coming out, and what the film and all of everything else that she has done over the time is going to lead to as far as the exhibit's concerned?
Thank you. So, as I mentioned, I'm an English major, English writer, and I wanted to tell her story in a lot of different ways. So through PNW, I am writing a complete documentary of her life and creating an online exhibit. But then I've also taken a creative side to tell her story in a creative nonfiction way. And so we will be filming this month at the Barker Mansion. I'm very, very excited. Working with Tony Panic from Panic in the Region on the filming aspect of that. And the film will be done and edited and completed and will be visible at the LaPorte County Historical Society Museum the first week of May. So we're really excited about that and hoping that a lot of people can relate to the story in that creative way. In addition to that film, we're also going to be showcasing an original Kissel car, and we could not be more excited. Through the research, we have been able to connect with the Kissel Car Club and the editor of the periodical for that club. Lynn Kissel and his wife, Jeannie Kissel, are the owners of a 1914 Kissel Touring. and they have agreed to allow us to showcase that, to inform the public about that part of Anita's story at the museum. So we'll be decorating the car very similar to how Anita's car looked in some of the photographs taken of her journey at the Princess Theater. And we could not be more excited. There are only a few surviving Kissels left in the country. And the Kissel that we were lucky enough to connect with actually has an incredible story of its own.
Oh. I understand, too, besides the car that will be on display at the museum, that you have some other artifacts that are going to be out there, too, that all fit very well together with not only the documentary, but about the story of the life of Anita King.
Yeah, so thanks to the PNW History Department, the English Department, and the Women's Commission of Michigan City, we were able to put together the funding, first of all, to make all of this happen, and secondly, to preserve some of Anita's original films from the Library of Congress. Due to the year that these films were made so long ago, they're very fragile, very highly flammable. Unfortunately, so many of our silent movies have been lost because of this.
Oh, yes.
And all of Anita's surviving films have not yet been preserved. So through my mentors at PNW, I've been able to locate these films and work with the Library of Congress to preserve them and bring a copy home to the museum. So that will also be on display. And it's so exciting to not only showcase that to the community, but just to protect that part of history.
I understand that the exhibit itself opens up May 1st, and that's when people can see the touring car and all of the artifacts that you've been able to help put together, and as well as the documentary that is coming up. Is there anything else that is planned through the rest of the year, certainly into the summer months, about Anita King, about the films that that she performed in, even though they're not in great shape, unfortunately? I know that you wanted to make sure that they're still around for posterity.
Yeah, so the exhibit will be open all of May, all throughout the summer. The LaPorte County Historical Society is planning a car show in July where they're going to put an extra spotlight on that Kissel that we're showing. The film that we're filming at the Barker Mansion will be showcased at other film festivals in the summer and in the spring. So we're just going to promote it and show it as much as possible. As I mentioned before, we're also working with her great niece, Lucianne Boardman. So she is sharing so many original photographs with the family and Anita's early life, as well as different artifacts from her time in acting with the exhibit as well. So we're very, very excited.
Kayla Vasilico is a senior with the Honors College at Purdue University Northwest, and she, along with a lot of people in LaPorte County, especially from the LaPorte County Historical Society, are putting together an exhibit on silent movie actress Anita King, who is from Michigan City. And she's definitely the person who could be defined as the American dream, that she's had the goals of the highest aspiration that maybe have been impossible, but she's managed to have achieved them in her lifetime. And she's now a symbol of courage, determination, and feminine strength. Kayla, thank you very much for telling us about Anita King, and the best of luck on the exhibit and the film that's going to be shown here in Northwest Indiana this summer.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you tomorrow.